Welcome to Tungsten, Bulletproof Hacks for the Moth-Eaten. I'm Christine Bruce. Consider me your grandmotherly accomplice for the next half hour. Tungsten broadcasts at the saddest hour on Wet'suwet'en territory through CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC. In this episode, I want to consider the notion of dogs as protagonists. We'll consider two books, both written by noted women authors, that present the notion of dogs as vehicles for feminist advocacy, and then a third book whose doggy opinion of his association with a certain project was less than willing. Let's go get into some canine mischief together. According to an article in Science World, dogs can have many positive effects on the lives of their owners. They influence social, emotional, and cognitive development in children, promote an active lifestyle, provide companionship, and have even been able to detect oncoming epileptic seizures or the presence of certain cancers. But can they share their thoughts and opinions with us? Most often, this sort of behavior is categorized as anthropomorphism, which is when you attribute human characteristics or behavior to someone non-human, in this case, an animal. Books like Winnie the Pooh, Alice in Wonderland, and Peter Rabbit are classic examples of anthropomorphism, where animals are used as vehicles to convey important messages. The books I just mentioned are generally considered to be intended for a younger audience, but they all carry significant messages for any age. A few books that you may not have heard of, all of which are unquestioningly recognized as adult literature, have had an impact on my life. As a youth, I devoured everything written by authors I enjoyed, two of those being Virginia Woolf and John Steinbeck. Virginia Woolf was an English writer and is considered an important modernist 20th century author, having pioneered the use of stream of consciousness as a narrative device. Woolf was a prolific writer with such titles as Mrs. Dalloway, A Room of One's Own, and To the Lighthouse. When I enthused about that last title to one of my English major friends, he recommended Flush. Flush, a biography, follows the life of a Cocker Spaniel that was the constant companion of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. On the surface, it's a fun little book, but later we'll explore the deeper meanings where the dog's experiences are reflective of things happening in his human companions. And like most people who have taken a few English classes in high school, John Steinbeck was a fixture on my bookshelves. I particularly enjoyed his shorter novels, like The Old Man and the Sea and Of Mice and Men. But have you ever read Travels with Charlie, In Search of America? Another shorter book with some interesting commentary from Steinbeck on what he's noticing as they travel. His dog Charlie has nothing much to add in the book's message beyond being a favorite travel companion, but I did find some audio of an interview with Steinbeck's son Thomas giving commentary on the book and his understanding of the dog's relationship with his dad. Not terribly deep, but awfully fun to hear. I bring these books to Tungsten today because I recently read a relatively new book called Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. The main character is Elizabeth Zott, whose life is a series of disappointments at the hands of men who refuse to take her scientific work seriously. Her dog, 630, plays a very minor role in the book, but whenever his opinions are shared, they underscore the message being relayed in the storyline. It's all about feminism. My dog will never be asked for his opinion on deep topics, but he is pretty sensitive to what's happening around him. When he doesn't trust someone, neither do I. When I'm feeling a bit down, he becomes attentive and cuddly. And at the beginning of every day, I can see on his honest, open face that he's working hard to ensure it will be the best day ever for both of us. Lessons in Chemistry doesn't sound like my taste in a book title at all. For one thing, I'm an English major who could never quite catch on in any of my high school science courses. And yet, Bonnie Garmus's delightful book captured my attention immediately. It recounts the experiences of a woman who's been sexually assaulted and refuses to apologize for stabbing her rapist, only the first in a series of all-too-familiar situations where her expertise gets overlooked and her opportunities reduced. Sounds dreadful, I know, but single mother Elizabeth Zott is determined to prove that she's a brilliant chemist in a man's world, which is 1960s America, even if she's forced to do it as a cooking show host. The deadpan tone and Garmus's sense of irony are wonderful vehicles for demonstrating that gender equality in that period was all but lost on so many people in powerful roles. Her dog, 630, doesn't appear frequently, but when he does, he usually offers editorial comments with some authority. His pleas for rational thinking make him the most logical character in the book. "Elizabeth Zott, you are going to change the world," he heard himself say. And the moment he said it, he knew it was true. She was going to do something so revolutionary, so necessary, that her name, despite a never-ending legion of naysayers, would be immortalized. And as if to prove that point, today she had her first follower. "Who's your friend?" he called out to her, shaking off the odd feeling. "It's 6:30," she called back, glancing at her wrist. That was Elizabeth's short-lived partner, Kelvin, who represents all those men whom we love but who are entirely unaware of their own privilege. Kelvin introduces the dog, 6:30, who's followed Elizabeth home one evening. Now I'm going to insert a couple of excerpts from the book that articulate how women in the 60s were viewed, not of course by all men, but by any man, and a lot of women too, who weren't prepared to give some thought to how ridiculous the social assumptions of the time were. And yes, I'm old enough to remember it. Elizabeth Zott held grudges too, except her grudges were mainly reserved for a patriarchal society founded on the idea that women were less capable, less intelligent, less inventive, a society that believed men went to work and did important things, discovered planets, developed products, created laws, and women stayed at home and raised children. She didn't want children. She knew this about herself, but she also knew that plenty of other women did want children and a career. And what was wrong with that? Nothing. It was exactly what men got. "But why was it so hard to get supplies?" Kelvin asked. "Hastings has plenty of money." Elizabeth looked at him as if he'd just asked how, with all those rice paddies, there could possibly be starving children in China. "Sex discrimination," she answered, taking the number 2 pencil she always wore either behind her ear or in her hair, and tapping it with emphasis on the table. "But also politics, favoritism, inequality, and general unfairness." He chewed on his lips. "But mostly sex discrimination," she said. "What sex discrimination?" he asked innocently. "Why wouldn't we want women in science? That makes no sense. We need all the scientists we can get." Elizabeth looked at him, astonished. She had been under the impression that Calvin Evans was a smart man, but now she realized he was one of those people who might only be smart in one narrow way. She studied him more closely, as if assessing what it might take to get through. Gathering her hair in both hands, she wound it twice before placing it in a knot on the top of her head. Then she secured it with her pencil. "When you were at Cambridge," she said carefully, placing her hands back on the table, "how many women scientists did you know?"
"None, but my college was all male."
"Oh, I see," she said. "But surely women had the same opportunities elsewhere, correct? So how many women scientists do you know? Do not say Madame Curie." He looked back at her, sensing trouble. "The problem, Kelvin," she asserted, "is that half of the population is being wasted. It's not just that I can't get supplies I need to complete my work. It's that women can't get the education they need to do what they're meant to do. And even if we do attend college, it will never be a place like Cambridge, which means they won't get offered the same opportunities, nor afforded the same respect. They'll start at the bottom and stay there. Don't even get me started on pay. And all because they didn't attend a school that wouldn't admit them in the first place."
"You're saying," he said slowly, "that more women actually want to be in science."
She widened her eyes. "Of course we do. In science, in medicine, in business, in music, in math, pick an area." And then she paused, because the truth was, she'd only known a handful of women who wanted to be in science, or any other area for that matter. Most of the women she'd met in college claimed they were only there to get their MRS. It was disconcerting, as if they'd all drunk something that had rendered them temporarily insane. I include the next excerpt because I like how Calvin's beginning to see things from a woman's perspective. It's always wonderful when you find you have an ally, especially from among the horde you thought were against you. Life is never black and white, yes and no, good and bad. Some people just haven't thought it through. "About your work," he said, trying to redirect the battle. "I think I can fix it." "I don't need you to fix anything," she said. "I'm perfectly capable of fixing my own situation."
"No, you're not."
"Excuse me?" "You can't fix it because the world doesn't work that way. Life isn't fair." This infuriated her, that he would tell her about unfairness. He wouldn't know the first thing about it. She started to say something, but he cut her off.
Look, he said, life has never been fair, and yet you continue to operate as if it is. As if once you get the few wrongs straightened out, everything else will fall into place. They won't. You want my advice? And before she could say no, he added, don't work the system, outsmart it. These last two clips from Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus take us to the place where Calvin leaves us, and 630's contributions to the conversation become diminished. In the first clip, 630 is preparing the listener for some bad news. In the second clip, well, it's fairly self-explanatory. 630 didn't like the police parking lot, especially the way the police backed out in such a sloppy hurry. He didn't even like the friendly policeman, who sometimes waved to them as he and Calvin jogged by, their slow trudge in sharp contrast to Calvin's vigor. They seemed depressed, in 630's opinion, shackled by low pay, bored by routine, unchallenged by the endless minor emergencies that never called upon the life-saving training they'd learned at police academy. So this is just after the accident happens. He wanted more than anything to go to Calvin's side, to dip his face close to his nostrils, to lick his wounds, to stop everything from going any further than it already had. But he knew from 10 feet away. Even from 10 feet away, he knew. Calvin's eyes drifted shut. His chest stopped moving. He watched as they loaded Calvin in the ambulance, a sheet over his body, his right hand hanging off the side of the gurney, the snapped leash still wrapped tight around his wrist. 630 turned away, sick with sorrow. With his head down, he turned and went to give Elizabeth the bad news.
This is called I Love My Dog.
I Love My Dog was Cat Stevens' debut single. It's been described as the greatest song about a dog written by a cat.
I love my dog as much as I love you. You may fade, my dog will always come through. All he asks from me is the food to give him strength. All he ever needs is love, and that he knows he'll get. So I love my dog as much as I love you. The you may fade, my dog will always come through. All the pay I need comes to shine through his eyes. I don't need no cold water to make me realize that I love my dog as much as I love you. Do you may fade, my dog will always come through. As I love you, the you may fade, my dog will always come through.
Different way of looking at the world, not just what the corporate media want you to see, but a different picture, a different understanding, but a different picture, different understanding. Not only can you hear it, but you can participate in it. You can add your own thoughts, you know, and you can learn something and so on. Well, that's the way, people become human, you know. That's the way you become human participants in a social and political system.
I enjoy reading biographies. They offer insight into people who've done something, which can help me understand how their life developed the way it did. Flush, a biography, provides insight into the society of the time of his human companion, Elizabeth Barrett, who lived from 1806 to 1861. The storyline follows the dog's early days in the country, to his adoption by Miss Barrett and their life in London, on to his final days with the then-married Elizabeth Barrett Browning in Italy. While in London, the dog is taken for ransom, which was a common problem at the time. Interestingly, Virginia Woolf is one of only a few women writers before 1950 to have been recognized with both worldwide critical acclaim and mainstream success. Oddly, though, you never hear about her 1933 novel Flush, a Biography, which is peculiar because at the time of its publication, the novel was Woolf's most popular book. And I quote, "Flush is usually viewed through two poles of characterization, as a feminist allegory and as the biography of a dog. Susan Squire's Flush's journey from imprisonment to freedom is a feminist perspective of the novel, demonstrating how it could be read as a calling out of the patriarchy for its marginalization of women, especially since Flush's biography contains several important parallels between his experience and that of the woman writer, both Miss Barrett and Woolf. This is evident in how Flush's social position as a house pet parallels Miss Barrett's as a woman's in Victorian society. Squire observes, for example, how the men in Miss Barrett's life seem to dictate what should and will happen when Flush is kidnapped, while completely disregarding her own and Flush's feelings on the matter, noting that both Flush and his mistress are equally subject to the wills of the men around them. Taking this into account, Squire argues that the novel must be taken seriously, particularly from a feminist standpoint. Scholars usually accept this view of the text, especially given Woolf's A Room of One's Own, which includes explicitly stated views on women in the Victorian patriarchy. And there are parallels between Miss Barrett's existence as a woman and Flush's existence as a companion, and the fact that Miss Barrett was a writer, and nearly every female Victorian writer, heck, any female writer throughout history, if you ask me, will argue for more women writers and a more accepting society. I was reminded of Flush this spring while reading a reissue of a December 2008 article in the New Yorker magazine entitled Shaggy Dog Story by Kate Julian. The article draws attention to an increase in dog thefts in New York City. The dogs may not have been famous, but their owners certainly are. The reissued article begins, "The English poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who was born on this day in 1806, was the devoted owner of a cocker spaniel named Flush, a spoiled pup who, remarkably, was kidnapped and ransomed no fewer than three times. He later became the subject of a biography by Virginia Woolf. In 2009, during a dog-napping terror that briefly hit the Upper West Side, Kate Julian considered the history of Flush and other famous pinched pets." There's nothing like a charming introduction to a topic to get me into the mood. The author's comments introducing her book, Flush, a Biography, certainly got my attention. Chapter 1, 3 Mile Cross. It is universally admitted that the family from which the subject of this memoir claims descent is one of the greatest antiquity. Therefore, it is not strange that the origin of the name itself is lost in obscurity. Many million years ago, the country which is now called Spain seethed uneasily in the ferment of creation. Ages passed. Vegetation appeared. Where there is vegetation, the law of nature has decreed that there shall be rabbits. Where there are rabbits, Providence has ordained there shall be dogs. There's nothing in this that calls for question or comment. But when we ask why the dog that caught the rabbit was called a spaniel, then doubts and difficulties begin. Some historians say that when the Carthaginians landed in Spain, the common soldiers shouted with one accord, "Span! Span!" For rabbits darted from every scrub, from every bush. The land was alive with rabbits, and span, in the Carthaginian tongue, signifies rabbit. Thus, the land was called Hispania, or Rabbit Land, and the dogs, which were almost instantly perceived in full pursuit of the rabbits, were called spaniels, or rabbit dogs. So, here's a snippet from Flush, a biography, where Elizabeth Barrett is considering her options. And as a feminist, there's really only one. Rescue her dog, regardless of the advice the men in her life are insisting she follow. Lying on her sofa, Miss Barrett read the letters. How easy it could have been to yield. How easy it would have been to say, "Your good opinion is worth more to me than 100 Cocker Spaniels." How easy it would have been to sink back into her pillows and sigh, "I am a weak woman. I know nothing of law and justice. Decide for me." She had only to refuse to pay the ransom. She had only to defy Taylor and his society. And if Flush were killed, if the dreadful parcel came and she opened it and out dropped his head and paws, there was Robert Browning by her side to assure her that she had done right and earned his respect. But Miss Barrett was not to be intimidated. Miss Barrett took up her pen and refuted Robert Browning. "It was all very well," she said, "to quote Donne, to cite the case of Gregory, to invent spirited replies to Mr. Taylor." She would have done the same had Taylor struck her, had Gregory defamed her. Would that they had. But what would Mr. Browning have done if the banditti had stolen her, had her in their power, threatened to cut off her ears and send them by post to New Cross? Whatever he would have done, her mind was made up. Flush was helpless. Her duty was to him. But Flush, poor Flush, who has loved me so faithfully, have I a right to sacrifice him and his innocence for the sake of any Mr. Taylor's guilt in the world? Whatever Mr. Browning might say, she was going to rescue Flush, even if she went down into the jaws of Whitechapel to fetch him, even if Robert Browning despised her for doing so. I'm particularly fond of this next excerpt, where Flush discusses social station among dogs. It's probably the best, most pointed commentary on race and snobbery that you'll ever read from a canine perspective. But soon Flush became aware of the more profound differences that distinguished Pisa. It was in Pisa that they were now settled, from London. The dogs were different. In London, he could scarcely trot around to a pillar box without meeting some pug dog, retriever, bulldog, mastiff, collie, Newfoundland, St. Bernard, fox terrier, or one of the 7 famous families of the Spaniel tribe. To each, he gave a different name, and to each, a different rank. But here in Pisa, though dogs abounded, there were no ranks. All, could it be possible, were mongrels. As far as he could see, they were dogs merely. Gray dogs, yellow dogs, brindled dogs, spotted dogs. But it was impossible to detect a single spaniel, collie, retriever, or mastiff among them. Had the Kennel Club, then, no jurisdiction in Italy? Was the Spaniel Club unknown? Was there no law which decreed death to the topknot, which cherished the curled ear, protected the feathered foot, and insisted absolutely that the brow must be domed but not pointed? Apparently not. Flush felt himself like a prince in exile. He was the sole aristocrat. He was the only purebred Cocker Spaniel in the whole of Pisa. Flush has just had his coat removed because he's been infested with fleas. And once it's done, here we are. They cast his collar into the dustbin and snatch the works of Voltaire from the cupboard. So Flush scampered off, clipped all over into the likeness of a lion, but free from fleas. "Flush," Mrs. Browning wrote to her sister, "is wise." She was thinking, perhaps, of the Greek saying that happiness is only to be reached through suffering. The true philosopher is he who has lost his coat, but is free from fleas. One last book that includes a dog, Travels with Charlie, In Search of America by John Steinbeck, was something I read years ago, mostly because I liked Steinbeck so much. The book doesn't offer any feminist arguments, and certainly not from the dog's perspective, but it did give teenaged me a lot of insight into the United States. Travels with Charlie is basically a travelogue that documents a driving trip that Steinbeck took with his brown standard poodle, Charlie, around the U.S. in the 1960s. I read the book in the early 70s, so it was timely. Steinbeck wanted to try to answer many personal questions about his country. The big one being, what are Americans like today, given how much he'd written about his fellow man as an author? In the end, Steinbeck was disappointed. Steinbeck and Charlie travel throughout the states in a specially made camper named Rocinante, named after the horse of Don Quixote. The journey starts on Long Island, heading north along the Pacific Northwest and down into his native Salinas Valley, across to Texas, up through the Deep South, and back to New York. All told, the trip covered nearly 10,000 miles. At the time, I found his commentary elucidating, and I'd encourage you to get a copy. Meanwhile, I happened to find some editorial comments that I believe Steinbeck's poodle, Charlie, would have liked to have shared with you on his feelings about the journey and the family that loved him. This is an interview from July 2010 with Thomas Steinbeck, son of John Steinbeck, through a project called Carlsbad Reads Together.
In the joy of this journey, right, we have to imagine that my father is, to a more or less a degree, sort of anthropomorphizing like crazy, which was a necessity because if he was honest about what Charlie really felt, there'd be no book, right? You had to pick him up to take him in and out of the truck. He hated that. He hated being lifted. Would growl at you. But indeed, to get him out and to get him in, you had to lift him up and down. And not only that, when my father stayed over at some hotel someplace, Charlie, of course, was not let in the hotel room. He had to sleep in the truck. Well, for a Frenchman, this is a damn insult. You know? And for a French dog, even worse, because he made his displeasure known, so we say, in doggy ways. Little doggy editorials left here and there to tell my father exactly what he felt about crossing the country in the back of a truck with him. You know? At any rate, it's a great vehicle, though. And I love this dog a lot myself. We and I had a great time together. And there's an incident later on after they came back, in which we were, which is pretty much about, and I'll shorten it for you. We were plagued by rabbits, and my father thought he was something of a gardener, which is a joke, but at any rate, and he wanted his own little vegetable garden, and the squirrels were into it, the rabbits were into it, the gophers were into it. We were feeding animals for miles around in all directions. And it only got worse because my father would go to the hardware store and try to buy those gewgaws to keep the birds and everything away. By the time he finished, the thing looked like a Buddhist temple. Not only did it not keep the animal away, it advertised the food for miles around. There's blinking and little lights flashing and all kinds of stuff. It just lined up to get more and more and more. So at any rate, my father decided that was really it. And my father was not a hunter or a fisherman who liked shedding blood. In fact, I don't remember ever him hunting at all, actually. And when he went fishing, he didn't use a hook because he felt that would interrupt his train of thought. He wanted the boat, he wanted the line, he wanted to be left alone, but the fish were like, that was too complicated for him. And if something did bite it, then he'd have to haul it up. He'd give it a lecture and then throw it back. What a stupid fish, there's not even a hook. Throw it back. I watched him do this many times. At any rate, he'd finally had it with the rabbits and decided, because we all had guns and we learned how to shoot, said, we've got to go out and get rid of the rabbits. And you go out on our lawn, there'd be like 65 rabbits sitting on our lawn in the evening, just like Disneyland. This is it, you know? So we went out, and there was quite a rabbit slaughter. Now, one thing that was really famous about Charlie is he hated gunfire. He was French. And he hated confrontation. And because he could never quite tell whether it was being aimed at him or somebody else, but he didn't like it, and he didn't like bloodshed of any kind. Well, yeah, we'd really decimated the rabbits out there. It was a big battle. We called it the Battle of Bluff Point. And the rabbit sort of lost. But the worst part about it was that Charlie disappeared. He'd have nothing more to do with us. He was gone. I mean, it's one thing for Charlie to disappear. As you know, dogs do. They go on little dog parades with their fellow dogs up and down the roads. Yeah. And they go off for a while. But they always come back home. And Charlie didn't come back home. And 2 days later, he still hadn't come back home. We began to worry. We went searching everywhere for this dog. And my father suddenly figured out what had gone on. He said, Charlie just had it. He was going to go find another family to live with. It was enough he'd been dragged across the country with bad bowels in a truck. Now we're shooting everything in sight. That was it. I'm out of here. And he disappeared. Well, our house on Long Island was surrounded by tule reed patches that we used to make forts in. They're great, tall, you know, 18-foot reeds. And one day I'm out there. This is about 3 or 4 days after he disappeared. And I'm going down this path. And I suddenly look in this little clearing. And there's Charlie lying in the middle of the clearing. And I go to approach him, and he, for the first time that all the years I've known him, he barked and growled at me, and he showed teeth. He just let me know, you get any closer, you're dead meat. And I'm, whoa, this is not the French dog I know. And it became a real problem. And finally, I went and got some food for him, and I brought it back, and he finally sort of let me get a little closer and closer, and then he got off, and I suddenly realized he'd been sitting in one place and hadn't moved in that entire time. And when I got him to move, I found he was sitting on a rabbit's nest. And there were baby rabbits in the rabbit's nest. He was looking after the survivors of the Battle of Bluff Point. Ah, French. Sometimes it's good to be French. And he wouldn't come, and it was a couple of days before he'd come back home again. And from that point on, he never treated us the same way again. He thought we were completely out of our minds. And he was right. I think he was really right. Because ultimately, the fact that we'd knocked off a number of rabbits didn't interrupt their breeding program. So now we had twice as many rabbits than we did before, when they had sort of territorial and keep the other ones out of it. But I was always very stunned at that sensitivity in a dog that would look after rabbits and was so ashamed of us. He really was. Have you ever had a dog ashamed of you? It's a terrible feeling. It's one thing to be ashamed of your dog, but to have your dog be ashamed of you. You know, and for moral purposes, it's one thing I don't like the way you dress, but to be, you know, to cast aspersions on your morality. So at any rate, in respect to Traveling Charlie, I want you to think of Charlie as one of the most unique characters that I've ever met. And I think, I know my father loved him deeply, but as gentlemen love each other, you know, they sort of left each other alone. And they took walks together, but my father would talk to him very seriously about things. But Charlie was one of these characters that just never took us very seriously. We were just odd Americans. And he knew this would be over, that, you know, I remember my father said at one point, we had to put Charlie in a kennel, and he said, you know, Tom, he said, you know, knowing us is going to take the sting out of death for this dog. You know? Oh, I'm out of here at last.
Okay, my question would be, his sense of humor, you've done a great job showing his sense of humor, and that's one of the things I think it was Peter Benchley writing an obituary, said every obituary missed his sense of humor, mm-hmm. and that he was a very, very funny man at all times. And I guess my favorite illustration of that is he used to dye Easter egg black. Easter eggs black. So could you talk more about that?
Well, no, that was just part of it. But I've got to tell you, seeing his sense of humor, Travel with Charlie was the song he wrote for Charlie. And do any of you know this song? I forgot what it's in the book. Is it in the book?
No.
Oh, Charlie Dog, they're calling you from. Well, the one thing that Charlie really loved, he loved being sung to. And my father liked writing silly songs. He also loved Pogo. You remember Pogo, the great comic book character? He loved Pogo. And he loved Al Capp's comics. Just the strangest, the weirdest stuff my father loved. So my father wrote this song for Charlie, and Charlie loved it. And he'd sit there while my father would sing it again and again and again and again. And I'll sing it for you. Because it's very short. It says, oh, Charlie Dog, they are calling you a frog. Such an insult pretty poodle never had. But you sit there in the flood with your whiskers full of mud and the polywogs refer to you as dad. But we did live on a point of land and we had a lot of mud and Charlie liked crabbing. That was his hobby. He liked going through the water and you see a crab and he'd jump on it. Of course, the crab would escape. So this dog was two-toned for most of its adult life. It was sort of brown on top and this rust brown on the bottom where it touched the water. And he'd come in, and my father, Charlie would stay there. If my father sang it a dozen times, the dog would listen to it a dozen times, two dozen times. That's what I thought was funny. Maybe that's not that funny. I don't know. I think it's funny.
You've been listening to Tungsten, Bulletproof Hacks for the Moth-Eaten. Tungsten is produced by Christine Bruce, aired through CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC. Available anytime at smithersradio.com or anywhere you get your podcasts. In case you need a little fix this week, I'll leave you with a life hack. Go spend some time in the company of a dog. In my experience, dogs tend to treat people like they're marvelous creatures. They act like we're very talented, ethical, playful, and kind. And because they treat us so well, it can bring out the best in us. A dog certainly makes you feel that you're never alone.